If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
I really wanted to put something together that was focusing on the approach for gamers of we're not doing it to perform and get on stage in any way. We're doing this so that we can all be better storytellers and collaborators. So it's not just for GMs, it's for players, it's for LARPers. There's something for everybody.
Karen Twelves and Sean Nittner are associated with many of the games featured on this podcast. Blades in the Dark, Agon, and Fiasco, to name a few. I sit down with them and discuss the newest book from Evil Hat Games, Improv for Gamers, 2nd Edition. Karen explains how attending a beginner's workshop for improv turned into her creating her own workshops to arm players and GMs with better tools for telling better stories. We learn how the demand for these exercises and lessons led to a book, and how they are now being updated and released in a new 2nd Edition. Now, I got an early copy, and it is packed with gold you'll use. When this episode is released, Evil Hat is crowdfunding it on GameFound. For $25, you get the printed book and the PDF. And for $15, you can get just the PDF. Use the link in the notes to check it out. You can scroll down and find it. All right, stick around to the end when we discuss Kickstarter's announcement to migrate to a blockchain platform and how that impacted where they decided to run this campaign. Patrons of Third Floor Wars help me keep this podcast, the YouTube, and Twitch channels viable. Thanks to all of you who support us there. A hearty thanks and welcome to a few of our newest patrons. Lucas Mahan, Dan Porter, Naomi Dempsey, who recently upped her support, B-Match, and Masukomi. Join them and the other patrons on our patron-only Discord, where we talk games, give advice, and recently have pop-up watch parties of various episodes. Okay, sit back, relax, and enjoy my time with Karen and Sean.
To unplug and play games around the table. Greetings, friends and floorheads, to Tabletop Talk from Third Floor Wars. If you love tabletop gaming, you are in the right place. Listen as Craig delivers in-depth discussions and interviews with game designers, creators, insiders, and experts. Learn from the people making and playing the role-playing, miniature, and board games you love.
Howdy, friends. Craig here. Today, we're talking to Karen Twelves and Sean Nittner. Now, Karen is an editor and linguist and has enjoyed working on such projects as Blades of the Dark, Fiasco, Dialect, and Thirsty Sword Lesbians. Karen, those are some really good games. Welcome to the Third Floor.
They are. Thank you so much for having me.
I just got off running Blades on
wow,
the street.
Oh, it's such a good game.
Nice.
It really is. Mm-hmm. It really is. So I always force people to do this on my show, and I apologize in advance. I love hearing everybody's origin story. Mm-hmm. So at one point, Karen, you knew nothing about tabletop role-playing game. You didn't know, you know, I could roll dice and pretend to be other people. And then it was put in front of you for the first time. Can we go back there?
Yes, it was the 90s in high school. And my friend Ben said, would you like to join my Dungeons and Dragons campaign? And I said, yes. And that was it. I remember like we were rolling up characters like in a park somewhere because we were teenagers and like that was the only cool place to go. I was in a campaign with some friends from high school, kind of throughout high school, and then started exploring other games in college. And so I had this kind of progression of the types of games I was playing and how I was learning about and getting more introduced to more narrative games, GM-less games, and a lot of different styles of RPG.
When do you think it got its hooks in you, though? So did it happen back in high school, my first
time? Immediately.
Yes. Was it really?
Immediately. Yeah. I was like, this is awesome. This is the best thing. I want to find more people that do this wherever I go.
So when adult Karen thinks back to high school Karen, and like looking back in it, do you have a sense of why? So why do you think it just grabbed onto you back then?
I mean, I always liked playing pretend as a kid.
Yeah.
And it was just fun. And we were, of course, doing the thing that high schoolers always do when you play D&D, which we were just being ridiculous. We were just the most ridiculous plot lines. We were getting like horrifyingly creative in how we were like terrorizing monsters. So it was just a lot of fun and freedom that I, you know, didn't have in any of my other pastimes.
So when you talked about your journey afterwards, right? So, you D&D, then you started finding out more games and more games. If we were to plot the map of from there to here, and I were to put some landmarks, what do you think were some of the big games that really kind of opened you up or changed you as a gamer, as you look back on it?
In college, I played a lot more World of Darkness, but I always kind of stayed away from Vampire. I don't know why. I played a lot of Werewolf.
Interesting.
So, yeah, so still very emo and brooding. You know, I went to Sarah Lawrence, so checks out. And a liberal arts college in New York. And then I started playing Aberrant and Adventure with some friends, and those were really fun. And Adventure specifically really introduced me more to pulp action style games. And so that was a very different type of story that we were telling. And suddenly you weren't worrying about protecting your characters so much. You were really putting them in amazingly dangerous, swashbuckling types of situations. So that was very fun. And then I remember moving back to Oakland and going to a little mini con at Endgame, our former friendly local game store. And I sat down for a game of Spirit of the Century, which again was like more pulp action. I was like, oh, this is like more streamlined. This is exciting. And I met such great people there. And Endgame had all of these like monthly meetups and little mini cons all the time. I got to play a lot of different games. And so that's where I got introduced to Dogs in the Vineyard, Primetime Adventures, Fiasco, I think was the big one that blew my mind again of like what a game could be.
Yeah. Yeah. It's incredible. It's funny. Do you find yourself, you know, as you get, you know, you play games that are so elegant now, like that's the word I always amazing how elegant games are now. And, you know, you go back to, you know, some of the older games, even World of Darkness. And, you know, at the time they were ahead of their time, but if you go back and look at them, they're clunky. What I'm always curious to know is, do you ever find yourself getting nostalgic? So is there a game that, you know, you probably wouldn't enjoy playing again because of your sensibilities now and what you enjoy in a game, but is there a game or a campaign that you are nostalgic of for?
I think the campaign I'm most nostalgic for, but I would 100% go back to it, is a Pathfinder campaign that I was in for about 3 years. And that was just a lot of fun. I would go back to it because as long as it was under the same conditions where Sean had all of our character sheets in Hero Labs. And so I didn't have to do any math. And he liked building characters. So when I would say, I think I want to try to be better in this thing, he would go find the feats. And so I didn't have to do any of the work. And that made Pathfinder very playable for me because I get so overwhelmed by all the options and the math and the strategizing of like, oh, if you don't pick the right feat, then like this character is not going to build well. And I'm like, I don't have the foresight to do that. I don't want to.
You need an assistant player is what you're saying.
Yes. And so Sean did that. And that was great. And that was a really fun game with some really great players. And we told some really amazing stories. But being able to streamline the process of kind of that level of crunch for me was great.
Right. Very.
That was also a game where we often would sort of stop the D20 hex crawling kind of Pathfinder standard adventures and ask, like, what's the family drama? What's the hot goss between you and your aunts? And like, there was lots of indie gaming sensibilities that we brought to that game.
We were all very much indie gamers. But, you know, it's not like we've never played those, you know, D20 games before. So
yeah, it's so hipster of you.
Yeah. It wasn't like any of us were like exploring that for the first time.
Sure.
Except for my friend Mia, who had never played Pathfinder before at all. And so she was still very new to that. She was the only person who had never played anything kind of in that D&D Pathfinder genre.
And did she... I mean, obviously, it sounds like the crunch was happened because of technology and the kind of the resources you have. Did she grab onto it real quick because of the quality of the table, or did it take her a second to gronk it?
I think she did her best. I think we really tried to make things easy for her. She was playing a spellcaster of some type, I think a cleric. And so she had a lot of options and things. And so we were all really trying to help her have an easy kind of reference sheet so she knew what to do.
Got it.
So she wasn't overwhelmed by all of her, you know, spell slots and things.
Yeah, I and this is not a knock on Pathfinder. I've tried. I've tried to read the book. I appreciate it for what it is. But I may not be smart enough to play. Is what it might, what it comes down to. And that is more about me than it is about Paizo's game. So my second guest is Sean Nittner. He's a gamer, podcaster, convention organizer, and Twitch streamer. In between all of that, he is also a project manager at Evil Hat Games and the co-creator of one of my favorite games, Agon. Sean, welcome to the third floor. Welcome back to the third floor.
Hey, Greg. Thanks for having me back. It's such a delight to be here. It's also fun to be like, I know what this, not only do I know this question because I remember you asking me, but also I'm like, I've heard Karen's version of this story before. I wonder how it's going to change. Because every time you tell these stories, you know, you add new details and things like that. So it's
what, how I got into gaming?
Yeah. I mean,
it's Ben's fault.
It's Ben's fault, I knew, but I didn't know the story about like making character sheets in the park. You know, it's a nice detail. So things we learn even about our loved ones on your show, Greg. think about the connections you're creating right now. But yeah, it's great to be back,
Greg. It's good to see you. And this is unintentionally kind of like Sean Nittner week, because not too far back we released an episode with you and John Harper, which is the audio from our round table, and on there we did talk about your origin story. But for anybody who does not know that, Sean, can we give people a sense of how you ended up where you are and where you fell in love?
Absolutely. It's not all that much different. I was in the middle school library when I heard a group of people all telling some weird story and having a good time, and that there was some talk about dragons and knights and things like that. And I kind of like crept around the corner between the stacks of books, and they were sitting at the table, and I was like, hey, what are you doing? And I think they probably said we're playing D&D. I don't remember what the exact answer was, but I said, can I play? And they're like, yeah, you're a gnome in a sack. And I'm like, I don't know what that means, but sure, sounds good. So I spent the whole session as a gnome in a sack. I don't know why the gnome was put into a sack. I don't really know my character's backstory, but I just kind of went and sort of poked in the sack occasionally. And that was a delight. I had zero agency and I was still having a great blast. So, I mean, you know, when they said I could actually make my own character that got to do things not in a sack, I mean, that was like the world expanding right before my eyes.
They set a really good low bar for you to come into it.
It was pretty easy to improve from there. And so, yeah, I followed a pretty traditional arc, not really dissimilar from Karen, you know, started with D&D, and then we had some weird games. I remember in high school, Mythos, Battle Lords of the 23rd Century, a lot of Palladium games. I mean, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, my heart. It's just like that game is so broken, but I still I still love it.
Way ahead of its time.
Even played Rifts, and Rifts was a just disaster, but, you know, we would just sort of play anything.
Yeah.
And then similarly, you know, because it was the 90s and it was cool, I was playing a lot of White Wolf games too. For mm-hmm. me, it was, I was playing Mage, but I was GMing, I was playing Werewolf, but I was GMing Mage. And really, really loved having a very long Mage campaign. It was fantastic. And then I started listening to Paul Tevis's Have Games Will Travel. And he was talking about games like Polaris and Dogs in the Vineyard. And I was like, whoa, those sound super cool. And I brought them to my local group and I got sort of mixed results. Mm-hmm. And they were like, where's the flanking bonus? What's the grappling rules? Right. And it was kind of mixed. I do remember a really terrible game of Fiasco that we played where we were all awful. And I would like to, I'm so glad that was never recorded. So sort of mixed reception, but like Karen, I went to Endgame and also to other cons and whatnot, and I saw a lot of folks sort of in the gaming, indie gaming space, and just got exposed to so many things and loved it. And so dove it. I mean, I had been a very enthusiastic gamer up until that point, but I hadn't really been in the biz, and that's what sort of drew me into working, putting on Big Bad Con, and before that, Good Omens Con, working at Evil Hat and just doing everything I can to be involved in the space.
Sean and I actually met over a game of first edition Agon.
Oh, no shit.
Endgame. Yeah. That was the first time we sat at a table together.
Yeah. We were playing big all heroes. Carl Rigney was running the game. Mm-hmm. And so Agon has a very special meaning.
For both of us, I guess.
I also ran a game of Agon in which I was dressed in a tabard and I was fully like cosplaying as the GM.
You were really into cosplaying as a GM at that time.
I was, yeah.
You were into that and tablescapes.
Yes, yeah. Very ornamented. I never did manscaping, but I did tablescaping.
Yeah.
We played a game of Apocalypse World, for instance, where I covered the table in a ton of pictures of old, like, rusted out Humvees and, like, beat up, half-submerged ATVs and things like that. And then so it was just the pictures all over. And then I covered it with a clear sheet of Mylar over top of it so that you could see through it, but it was protected from water. And then I just littered it with rusted crap, rusted pipes, rusted bike chains, cool. Whatnot. And we were playing on this table and people, this is also an end game. At one point, someone threw like some garbage on the center of the table, like a candy wrapper. And I was like, yeah, that's this game. And then everybody in the space just started throwing all their trash on it. And I was like, it's got a Mylar, it's got a plastic covering. It's fine. You're not going to damage anything like that. Do it. And so by the end of the game, like there was just a heap of
trash,
everybody's candy wrappers and soda cans and all this garbage. And,
that's how Sean became a LARPer.
Mm-hmm. Kind of. Yeah. I didn't realize I was LARPing, but I would stand up a lot and I would dress in character when I was mm-hmm. GMing.
Oh, that's great.
So yeah, that's my...
It's intimidating is what it is, Sean. Like,
I mean, the fact that Karen went out with me after a game, this is before we were in a relationship.
Oh, yeah. We went out for a drink after that.
Yeah. And I was in... Go on.
No, we ran into some friends of mine who had never met you before. And I don't think that they understood that that wasn't how you normally dress. Yeah. Because I was cosplaying to GM Apocalypse World.
Yeah. I had victory spikes in my hair. I had goggles. I had a bandolier of empty shotgun shells. I had fatigues on. Everything was distressed and worn. I mean, I looked like an Apocalypse World character, I thought.
I've got this image of Karen's friends pulling her aside and going, "Hey, Karen, you okay? Just blink."
They were remarkably chill. I still am astounded at how chill they were about it. They were like Burning Man people, and they were just like, yeah,
they were
whatever.
Fine.
Oh, yeah.
We were just having a beer.
They were not fazed.
You would have been an amateur Burning Man with that outfit.
Right, yeah. right, right.
All right, guys. So the Insider Insight series is my opportunity to sit down with designers, developers, artists, writers, and creators and learn how they approach their work. I try to understand their process, inspiration, and methods for crafting their creations. And we're going to start doing that with you, Karen. So to give everybody an idea of the reason we have come together today is a book called Improv for Gamers. And before we kind of dive in to how this came to existence, can we give everybody a little bit of an idea of what it is?
Yeah. Improv for Gamers is a book that is a collection of short theater games that you can play to practice different skills that are applicable to gaming. So these are the types of theater games that actors use in workshops and that improvisers use to practice skills like how to listen very carefully, you know, so active listening, memory. There's a lot of like you need to retain a lot of information in your head, how to just collaborate well with others, how to be enthusiastic and supportive of the people that you're playing with. So there's a lot that builds the foundation of how to improv. And in like when you take an improv class, normally the level one is just that. You're not doing scenes, you're not acting, you're learning the skills that you need that then will help you be a better performer. So this book is a way for people to practice those types of games in a fun way, because there's a lot of advice of, you know, improv is great for gaming. There's been so much discussion on that. I don't think it's a new concept at this point. But I think oftentimes it just ends with, and yeah, you should just take an improv class. And having taken improv classes myself from a variety of instructors, there are different brands. Every theater has their own style.
Okay.
So they might be promoting a different type of improv. Some theaters are doing honestly very dramatic things. They're not looking for comedy. They're doing very long improvised plays that could be, you know, very poignant and sad, or they might be doing horror, or they might be doing a Shakespearean musical. And so they're going to focus on training you for that. There are going to be other theaters that are focusing on comedy and doing more like very fast paced, very quick, staying on top of things, you know, get in, make the joke, get out. And those are all great. They're all fun to watch, but they're all going to focus on different things. And so they're all going to teach you a very different approach. And so I really wanted to put something together that was focusing on the approach for gamers. Of we're not doing it to perform and get on stage in any way. We're doing this so that we can all be better storytellers and collaborators. So it's not just for GMs, it's for players, it's for LARPers. There's something for everybody.
So what's interesting to me about that, so we now know, because we just heard it not too long ago, how you got into gaming. Mm-hmm. When did you take your first improv class and why was that? So when did you become like exposed to that?
This story is going to be remarkably similar. A friend of mine said, would you like to take an improv class? And I said, yeah, okay.
I'm not going to ask how you found cocaine then.
but I feel like we can. I feel like there's more connection there, though, because that was Chris Bennett, right? Who invited you. And did you meet Chris through Endgame?
I met Chris through Endgame. So he was a gamer. And so he said, I want to take this improv class. Would you be interested in taking it with me? And I said, yeah, sure. I was already interested in it, and it did seem like something that would be applicable. So yeah, he didn't end up staying with it. He took the 6-week class and then was like, all right, off to the next adventure and like fun thing that I do in my Chris Bennett life. And I was like, no, I am here. I am here to stay. I stayed with that theater for like 2 years. I joined their house troupe. I was performing like two nights a week. I then was in a couple different Bay Area troupes and I started teaching.
Very interesting. So it sounds to me, if I've heard this right, Karen, like you went into it with a gaming mentality to sorts, right? That you're like, this could help me with my gaming. Did I capture that right?
Yeah. Yeah. I was so excited after doing improv to then jump into, you know, those monthly mini cons. Cause I was like, I know how to bring it now. I am going to be fearless with my characters. I'm going to yes and everything. I'm going to be 100% invested in the story, not in my character winning. And it really changed my outlook and because I was playing all of these GM-less narrative games at the time, I was like, this is perfect. I am practicing the hell out of what I am learning.
So What was the transition then, Karen? Because there's a lot of people that have taken a lot of improv classes, but there's a very small group of people that have taught it. So what was that transition for you where you said, I'm not just going to participate, I have things to share?
There was a Apocalypse World game that I was in, and I'm not going to name names. And Sean, you can't name names either because this is recorded. But Sean knows who this was because he was there. We were playing an Apocalypse World game, and there were four players, and three of us had one story, and one person was really telling their own story. And they only cared about their NPC interacting with the GM. And they kind of were actively foiling the rest of us, trying to survive the apocalypse and whatever big disaster, whatever big disaster was on the horizon.
Right.
And it was very frustrating. And I came out of that and I was like, I'm going to have to teach this workshop, aren't I? Because I kept talking about it. I was like, man, it'd be so great if there was an improv class just for gamers so we could really focus on the parts that apply to our hobby. Because there's a lot in improv that doesn't apply.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh no, it has to be me, doesn't it? Because no one else is doing it, at least in my town. And so I got together with my friend Mia Blankensop, who I had mentioned joined our Pathfinder game. Mm-hmm. And she was still fairly new to gaming. So we were like, here's a game of Burning Wheel. Hang on. That was
amazing.
Her first game.
It was her very first game. And it was the gift. She was playing as the Dwarven Seneschal. And it was just like, just diving into the deep end. And The Gift is one of my favorite games to introduce people to Burning Wheel as well.
And it was very LARPy.
It's very LARPy.
So we were all doing great. Another person at that game was Matt Klein. And so the three of us got together and because Matt Klein is also a gamer and an improviser, and he was doing a lot of like corporate workshops and things from that nature. And Mia at the time had a lot more teaching instruction as an improv instructor than I did. So the three of us got together and I said, I want to run this workshop. I want to put it together. Let's brainstorm. So we had, I remember like a breakfast in a place in Oakland, and I was furiously trying to like take notes on this table that was like covered in plates of half-eaten eggs and toast and stuff. And just to set the scene. And we were thinking like, right, what are skills that you need in gaming? We're like, well, one of them is you need to actively listen. Okay, what is an improv game that we know that practices active listening? And we kind of worked backward that way of like, what do gamers need to be better at? What do we know from our experience in improv? What are the exercises that practice that? So we put together a whole lineup and then taught it for the first time at Endgame. And so the three of us, Mia was kind of at the time, because she had the most instructional experience, she was kind of the lead facilitator, and Klein and I were both the co-facilitators, and we were doing a lot of the more translating for gamers of what Mia was doing. And so we all kind of worked together and it was really great. It was so much fun. And we kept doing those at Endgame a few times after that. And then I submitted it to Big Bad Con. I started running it at like Go Play Northwest when I was up there. And then, as I started kind of picking up and going to more conventions, I started submitting it wherever I could. And we expanded to kind of improv for GMs. So then we really dove into what are some more GM specific skills. We did an improv for LARPers. So we did a lot more acting in the LARPing one of like, here's how to do like a full body character. Here's how to play with invisible objects if you're doing like a black box LARP and you don't have props. So we really started piecing together a lot of different things so we could kind of, again, have something for everybody. And those workshops were really great. And I kind of took over eventually teaching them myself. Mia moved down to LA and Klein just had a lot of other obligations and so couldn't always make it to conventions. And then, and I've been doing that for like over 10 years. I think that was the first one was in like 2012.
Wow. So I've got a question, Karen. Let's do a what if. Mm-hmm. Let's say that I'm out to the West Coast. I sign up for a con. I find that Karen's teaching her improv for gamers. I sign up for it. I'm super psyched. Mm-hmm. And to get ready for it, I happen to find a VHS tape of the first class you taught. And then I go to the one tomorrow. I want to know what changed, right? So from the first time you gave this class to over the last decade, what has happened to the class, whether it be from material, the way you teach it, it doesn't matter, but it's not the same one that you taught that first time.
That's so interesting. I've never thought about that. I'm not sure what would be different, because I like to think that it would have been perfect the first time.
I'm sure it was.
I do remember one thing from the very first one that sort of had to be edited out later on, which wasn't a bad thing. It wasn't anything that was awful. I took the class. So mm-hmm. I'm saying this as a perspective of an attendee of the class, is that Mia, as you had said, was still very new to games. Mm. And so when Mia was talking about the term game, she was often thinking about the term of an improv game. Mm-hmm. And an improv game, you can't lose. You play it for a few minutes and then it's over. It doesn't matter. And so there was a refrain.
I use the word exercise in the book a lot instead of game to show the difference between that. Of it's an improv exercise and a tabletop game. But we often refer to those exercises as games.
But has the exercises changed though, Karen? Or is it the same exercises?
Some of them are still the same.
Are they?
But I've certainly added more. And definitely expanded more on my focus of, are we just doing kind of an intro to improv and this is applicable for everybody? Or, as I said, are we focusing on a particular style? So am I going to do a workshop that's all on characters? You know, am I going to really drill down into one thing? And so I'll often pitch them very differently now to be more specific, unless I just want to do an intro class, which is also fun, just to give an overview. But back to Sean's story, I think Mia was trying to assure everybody that it wasn't a problem. But this was at Big Bad Con. This was the first Big Bad Con workshop, and because I remember it was a huge group, and she was trying to assure everybody that, you know, there was no winning in these games. And if you felt like you messed up, which is not possible, but if you felt like you did something wrong and you weren't happy with your choice and you thought, I messed up that game, you can just tell yourself, she said, it's just a stupid game. And everybody went, and she didn't know what she'd done. She looked at me like, what did I say? And I was like, man, it's not a stupid game, man. You can't, this is our lives. So we can repeat that again. That line didn't come back.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing.
And I can't imagine there's just a visceral reaction.
It was really fun. We all learned something that day.
Oh, I bet.
Another thing that was unique to the first ones that we ran at Endgame is that we would play a game after. So at conventions, I didn't have to do that. Right. And I could squeeze everything into a 2-hour time slot. But at Endgame, it was kind of a whole day. It was like a 4 or 5 hour event, because we would do a workshop, take a break and have lunch, come back and play Fiasco, I think, is one that we did frequently. We also played Archipelago. I've also, in later, actually, instances where I have put a game element on the end, I've ran like For the Queen or Ghost Court or some other game where then we can immediately put it into practice. And so that was part of the early one. It was really like a whole half day intensive.
So I come from a training background, and I'm going to ask this from that perspective. Can you think of a success story? And it's something that when I was training and giving workshops and things like that, that was my fuel, right? When I found that person and I saw it click. And I'd be curious if you can think of a situation where you saw somebody transform, that they came into the workshop with one perspective, with one set of skills, and really came out the other end and just made you, that night you went home and you know, damn it, I did it.
You know, I'm not sure, there's not one person cemented in my mind, but I have received really great feedback from a lot of people who have come up to me later, or found me at another convention and said, you know, that was so great. That made such a big impact. I started doing improv Or, you know, I started GMing because I thought it was really scary before. And then I just decided to try it out and it was great. So I have gotten really great feedback from people, though I don't have one like specific story that jumps to mind.
Is there any feedback that ever surprised you? Was there any time somebody who went to the workshop and told you this is what I got out of it? And you're like, oh, I didn't think you would get something like that out of it. Any surprises?
Yeah, the first thing that occurred to me, because again, in my mind, it was always an improv workshop and it was an intensive event. It didn't occur to me until later that people would want to play just one of these games with their group before a full session. And it's so silly now because that's such a thing that I encourage people to do. But at the time, somebody said, oh, yeah, I started playing, you know, a game or two with my table just to get warmed up. And I was like, well, that is brilliant, obviously. Yeah. I had just always been looking at it through the lens of this is a whole lesson that, you know, builds upon itself. And I was like, no, obviously you can take all of these. So many of them are fun little warm-up games anyways that you can just play with friends.
Oh, that's cool. That's cool. So at some point, workshop becomes a book. And I'd like to know how that happened.
Well, I was an ESL teacher at the time. And so I was making a lot of lesson plans anyways as a teacher. So, and again, when we started with Matt and Mia, I was writing up these kind of lesson plans for us to all go through. And they were very detailed. I was kind of scripting stuff to help Mia present things a little bit.
Yeah.
And I was writing down the detailed instructions for myself so I knew how it would go. So I had kind of a manual. I had a teacher's workbook for a while when I first went into teaching. And people started asking me, like, could I, like, take your notes? Like, where can I get these games written down?
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, there's only one other book that I've come across that I really like that I think is formatted in a similar way, where it just gives you a lot of games and not as much theory. Other times there's a lot of great books about the theory and the games are often kind of in the back, kind of in the middle, part of a story. So it's really, they're organized in a lot of different ways. But people were asking, like, where can I get the written rules for this? Cause I want to go run this with my friends. And so sometimes I would just like give people my sheet of notes at the end and like, here you go. But we started thinking about like, we should really put this down somewhere so people can take it themselves and teach their friends. And so that's where the first draft came from. It was kind of a more organized teacher's manual. And it was really pitched towards honestly like an improv teacher or other facilitator about how to teach this for gamers. And then I pitched it to Evil Hat as, you know, I have this book. It seems really popular. And I had a couple other people in mind. I pitched it to Evil Hat first to see if they would be interested. And they said, yeah. But then I gave the whole thing to my editor, Josh Yearsley, and he came back and was like, this seems written for somebody who's actually maybe not a gamer. Like, this seems written for somebody who is a trained instructor. And the people who are going to buy it are going to be the gamers who have never done improv before. I was like, yes, obviously, that is correct. So I will be right back. So I went and I rewrote the whole thing.
Wow.
So that it was coming from that perspective of you don't know improv and that's okay. You can pick up this game, you can flip to a page, the exercise is going to say, here's a gamer skill, here's how you use it, you know, here's how you can practice it, these are the instructions, here are some takeaways. And so it was very much then designed that anybody could kind of pick it up and easily facilitate.
And the whole format was also set up so that your audience can't see me do this, but I'm holding a book and I'm showing that if you open it to a single spread, the entire game, the entire exercise would be on a single spread. So could just look at it and go, that's it. It was very small, very containable. And we kept that.
Because I really wanted it to still feel like a workbook. you know, something that was an easy teaching reference.
So you create this workshop, you refine this workshop over time, you have these detailed notes because of that's, you know, that's in your blood as far as being, you know, what you were as a teacher and creating lesson plans. You make the first version of the book, you pitch it to Evil Hat. They great. Your editor comes back and says, no, it's garbage. You got to reread. And you read.
He did say it more diplomatically than that. But yes, he did say, like, I think that you've written this to the wrong audience.
So then you're done. The book is out and Evil Hat is selling it. And somehow you get an idea. I think there needs to be a second edition. And I want to understand what made you come back.
I just wanted to include more.
Yeah.
I was still continuing to perform and to teach and to take classes myself and learn more exercises. And I learned a lot more things. I thought, oh, this would be so good. And I was still teaching the workshops. So the workshops were evolving, but the book was now kind of stuck in the time of here's what the workshops were like in, you know, in 2017, but I was still moving on and refining them. And so there was a lot more content that I wanted to put in. And so we kind of kept talking about, like, well, when it finishes its print run, if we want to do another one, I would actually prefer to make a second edition. And I also wanted to change a lot of things because I wrote it always imagining that this would be something that people would do in person.
Oh.
Yeah. And then
a reasonable expectation so, 3 years ago.
Yeah. But also, like, it wasn't like Twitch streaming was new.
Right.
It wasn't something that I was doing a lot of. And so it wasn't something that I was imagining that people would want to use this for. But then I had more and more people kind of ask, like, well, does it work online? And I thought, well, of course it does. You just have to, you know, find a way to make it work. So if it says something like, oh, this play passes around in a circle, I don't know, determine what order you're going to go in beforehand. But I thought I really should go back and revise the language a little bit so it sounds a bit more open-ended. And there are still some exercises that really only work when everyone is in the same physical space. But I find that the takeaways from them are so valuable, I wasn't willing to let them go just because they wouldn't work in every format.
Now we say, okay, we're going to do, print run's over, we're going to do a second edition.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to crowdfund it.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to go with GameFound and not Kickstarter. And I suspect I know some of the story of why, but I want to assume nothing. Because I would imagine it was not driven by dollars, right? Because there's a real decision.
That would be a sensible reason for making a decision. Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess the first thing is was that, did you know going in from the beginning, like, we're going to crowdfund this and we're not going to do it on Kickstarter? Is that something that changed during this process?
It was a decision that we honestly just made earlier this year.
Oh, okay.
We had kind of always assumed that it would be Kickstarter because Evil Hat has had so many successful Kickstarters. And Improv for Gamers is not a moneymaker. I have to be humble in admitting that it's not the bestseller on their list of games. And so it was never going to make a lot of money on any crowdfunding platform, but it also is not terribly expensive to make.
Right.
So it had that going for it.
who can talk to me about the first conversation of saying, maybe we don't want to use Kickstarter?
I think Sean can speak to that more, because that was really a conversation that I kind of said, well, you know, the publisher is going to do what the publisher wants to do. I'm really fine with whatever you decide to, but it sounds like what's happening in the current climate of we're unsure what Kickstarter is doing with crypto, we might just want to try out a different platform. And this seems like a low risk book to do that with, because we don't need to raise a ton of money to make it happen.
Yeah, Karen captured it very well. Before I even broached the idea to her, I was talking internally with the rest of the folks at Evil Hat about the idea. And, you know, Kickstarter, still to this day, Kickstarter has been very unclear about what they're going to do with blockchain. We still have a lot of questions. We still see a lot of opportunity for harm that is unnecessary and that is not going to help the creators. We could be wrong, but there's way too many unknowns. So I want to sort of say caveat, this is not, we're not burning down, we're trying not to burn bridges here.
Sure.
We might go back to Kickstarter in the future, who knows?
I said crypto, but I meant blockchain, but in my mind, they're so mixed up together.
They're very intertwined. Mm-hmm. And not being sure of it, we started having discussions about, well, what are other crowdfunding platforms out there? What else could we use? And some of that conversation didn't even have to do with Kickstarter. Some of that came to, we as a company really need to be cognizant of not becoming too beholden to any one platform. Because, you know, you see this all the time. Patreon changes its pricing models. You know, different companies that you sort of do business with really control the market. And if you invest all your energy and all your work in there, then you're really at their mercy, no matter what. And you know, we were very frustrated with Kickstarter's resistance to unionizing a few years back. So this wasn't the first time that we had. I mean, we almost put the brakes on kickstarting Agon for that exact reason. But the unionizers were like, no, please use the platform. We want you to work on it. So we did it, but we did it with caution. Mm-hmm. And we put a little caveat in the Kickstarter that, we're sort of following their lead, but, we were prepared to back out if we needed to. And so this, we already had a little bit of a sour taste in our mouth, and the blockchain announcement just, and it being even less kind of understandable, because at least with the union, we were talking to KSU, and I was in active communication with several of the members, and like getting regular feedback. There's an advisory board. We've heard nothing from this mm-hmm. advisory board. Like we really don't know anything. So.
Oh, and there was also no knowing when anything was going to be announced. So we thought, well, do we wait and see? And potentially some big announcement comes right before or during our campaign, and everybody rightfully decides not to support Kickstarter and our project suffers because of that. Or, or do we go over to this other platform and maybe nothing comes of it with Kickstarter. Maybe they decide that they are not going to do blockchain and we didn't necessarily have to make the move. So it was kind of a timing thing too.
But we really wanted to, where we can, Evil Hat is not a huge company. Evil Hat isn't beholden to any shareholders. We have the flexibility to, we're sort of at a place where we're just big enough that if Improv for Gamers is not a huge smash success, that's okay. We will certainly survive. Mm-hmm. But we, we're not so profit driven that we have to, because clearly Kickstarter would have better discoverability. I don't know if it would have anything better than anything else, mm-hmm. but I know it would have better discoverability because they have 20 million backers instead of 700,000, right? Like there's just a numbers game there. But it seemed like Karen had mentioned that like Imperfect Game was just a good candidate to make an experiment with, to see what it was like and just to learn what other systems were. Mm-hmm. And so we looked at Indiegogo, we looked at GameFound, we looked at a few others, and I got some personal interaction with the GameFound CFO. He kind of walked me through everything, and I'm doing a lot of research. It looked like a really good platform. Like I had to say, blockchain or no, I love the interface. It's just it does things really well. Kickstarter, you can have a pledge level, and you can. Specify what's in it, but you can't really drill down to it. And with GameFound, you can, every single item can have its own image and its own description. And it's really easy to do add-ons, and you can build stretch goals in. And then add a bonus, because GameFound started as a pledge management company, like BackerKit, they build pledge management right in. So payment cost-wise, you don't have to pay twice. Normally Kickstarter charges you 5% off the top plus another 3% credit card fees, and then BackerKit has a couple different models, but usually you're going to usually be paying about 3% more. So it's you're sort of paying for your pledges twice,
right?
To use both of those formats. And with GameFound, they're charging the same 5% the Kickstarter is plus 3%, credit card fees. But that's it. That's one fee, and you don't get the secondary one. So there was also some attractiveness to that, and that I think we were talking about this before the call, we don't have an awkward transition phase where we're like, we went around one platform and now we're on the other. It's just one seamless, well, I think it's seamless. We haven't gotten there yet. I don't know for sure. Mm-hmm. But I believe it's going to be a seamless movement from preview of the crowdfunding campaign to the crowdfunding, which we're doing right now, and to the pledge fulfillment, which we'll do as soon as that happens. So.
What's frustrating for me, and I'm going to tell this being very self-aware, because I'm an old dude, right? I'm 50 years old. I'm an old man, right? So me saying, I don't understand that, you know, like whatever. Yeah, maybe I'm yelling at clouds, but I'm also not dumb. And the one thing that frustrates me, and this I think is ties to what you guys are talking about the silence or ambiguity from Kickstarter is, and I've yet to really get a coherent understanding or a coherent argument for blockchain. Mm-hmm. When I ask people who love it, they tell me what the technology does. Okay. They explain to me, this is a use case for it. Okay. But I've yet to hear a coherent understanding of why would a company like Kickstarter say we need to migrate to blockchain and it's going to be better for Kickstarter and it's going to be more importantly, better for the people that pledge on Kickstarter and the people that create on Kickstarter. And I encourage somebody at some point to make that argument, because it's very possible that the three of us are in our retirement home and they put us in a special section because we didn't get blockchain, right? We were the dumb. and I'm open to that being the case, but I will tell you right now, they're not making a good case. And I would like to see that.
I think there was one thing, Sean, that you were talking about that you saw there could be a benefit for blockchain.
I had one theory and I explored this, and it's true that it might be doable with blockchain, but when I looked into it more, it was also doable with an open API that didn't require blockchain. But nevertheless, I thought when they first made this announcement, I was like, Kickstarter can only be run in the US right now. And so US and a few other affiliated countries that Kickstarter has sort of approved. If someone's in the Philippines and they want to run a crowdfunding campaign, they cannot use Kickstarter. So what if they put the Kickstarter code, the code to running a crowdfunding, and they federate it so that anybody can, like Mastodon does. Like Mastodon is like the federated version of Twitter. Mm-hmm. Like anybody can set up their own Mastodon server, and then those Mastodon servers can talk to each other, and you can create your own social network, and you have a lot. It's you're not beholden to Twitter, right? So I thought maybe there's an argument to be made that you federate out another version of Kickstarter, and it's the Philippines version of Kickstarter, it's the Brazilian version of Kickstarter, it's some other country that previously didn't have access, and they can get that knock-on effect from the discoverability that we talked about before. You take the 20 million Kickstarter backers, and they're part of the same ecosystem. Kickstarter is going to charge them to use the API. Kickstarter is going to benefit from a more diverse platform, right? Kickstarter is going to get a lot of benefits from this, but other countries would too. And I still think that's a possibility, but I don't think there's any need for blockchain to do that anymore. I was like, maybe that would be it. But I'm not a programmer, but I know several. And I actually had a big Twitter conversation a while back where I was like, please somebody help me understand why blockchain, right? Please. And it really just, as far as I can tell, you get into blockchain and to that extent, crypto and NFTs, because you're hoping that it's the new hot, cool thing and you're going to get in early and make a ton of money off of it. There's not, I'm yet like yourself to see the true virtue of it. I see it as more of a scheme, especially with crypto and NFTs. Blockchain, maybe not, but I see it more as a scheme where it's like, you've got to convince more people to buy into it so that your value is cemented and grows. And if they don't, then you just invested all this time and energy and money into something that isn't real. And I mean, that's true with any currency, anything that you're trying to get people to invest in and believe in, but there's just no, like you're saying, there's no actual benefit to it. Like we have not seen, I understand a little bit of blockchain. I get the idea behind it. Like, well, we're not going to let banks control this stuff, but banks have gotten things like credit card charges down to a science where they cost fractions of a penny to do, whereas a blockchain transaction takes up to 100,000 times as much energy because there's so many different, and this depends on the crypto you're using, and it depends on whether it's proof of work or proof of stake. There's lots of variables here.
Correct.
But it takes so much more energy because there's tons of computers out there all competing for who gets to validate it, and only the one who won gets the reward. But everybody else still spent all that energy trying to validate it to beat them. And then there's this arms race of, well, I want to get the reward, so I'm going to have more and more machines to do it faster and faster. So there's just, even no matter how streamlined you can make blockchain, the inherent design of it is just going to be so much more energy intensive. And in this world of like environmental collapse that we're looking at, that just seems like such a horrific idea. So sorry, that's I'm a little bit on my soapbox there.
We had to both do a deep dive into what we didn't understand to try to figure out what all this meant.
Yeah, and like I said, you know, when I like to think I'm not that old of a man. Like when I come across something I don't understand, I do the same thing. Or I'm like, I need to figure this out, right? And God bless, you know, in this day and age, if you don't know something, that's on you because the whole world's at your fingertips, right? But yeah. To Sean's point, and to be clear, you know, I am open to blockchain. All right, I am blockchain curious. I've made my decision about NFTs and crypto as use cases. So that I've done I did my research, right? So I've made my decisions there. It's the underlying technology that I'm still waiting for as being a possibility. So I completely understand what you're saying. But to bring it back for a circle to what we were talking about on Craig's night of blockchain discussions, it is frustrating that how I agree that the frustration about how Kickstarter is communicating this and explaining this and giving a sense of timing and creating a huge unknown for a lot of people is frustrating. All right, last question. And I start with you, Karen. Whenever I talk to creatives, one of the things that I find fascinating is what they consume. So right now, is there a book, a movie, a game, a video game, something that has got its hooks in you? It's all you think about when you're not thinking about it. Like, are you obsessed with anything right now that you're consuming?
Oh, this is a hard question to answer. Because right now, for the past 2 years, my job has been as a technical editor. And so I read and edit all day. And when I'm done, I don't want to read. And so it's very sad that since I had this job, which is a wonderful job, it has been so great for me. I've been so happy to be in this field. My recreational reading has plummeted because I am tired. And, but it is still like such a joy to read a book that is already edited. That's wonderful. I do love doing that. So I find that I consume a lot more, TV and movies.
Okay. What have you been loving lately?
I really like heist movies. And I think that that also is something that we leaned into more in 2020 of just like, let's just watch movies where smart people steal money from rich people. Let's just watch more of that. I also spend, I think, way too much time on TikTok, which I love as like an entertainment feed because there's so many weird little skits and jokes and just bizarre, you know, like a 30-second punchline. And so it just gives me like such like little instant dopamines that I can just like keep pressing that button like a rat. So that is what I'm consuming a lot of right now, is just trying to get quick entertainment.
Sure.
Because my brain is a little too tired right now, because it is just taking a lot of focus for me to edit intensely, you know, for 8 hours a day.
I completely get that. How about for you, Sean? Is there a recent obsession, a show you binged the hell out of, a game you played a ton?
I was thinking about media. I was like, what am I reading? And Karen and I are often watching a lot of the same things, but, yeah. the book that I'm, listening to right now, audiobook I'm listening to, that is, the one I finished not too long ago was Gideon the Ninth by Desmond Muir. That's a fantastic game, fantastic book. I think the sequel is out. We're going to be out in a second. I'm going to hop on that. So a lovely, would be perfect for a Thirsty Sword Lesbians game. Just lovely, like apocalyptic setting. It's apocalyptic fantasy. It's beautiful.
Nice.
And the narrator, if you happen to listen to the audiobook, the narrator for it, she is just amazing. The way she portrays Gideon, just you fall in love with her immediately. And the other one that I'm still listening to, and it's taking me forever because I listen to it just in little bits, is Moby Dick. The book is atrocious. It's super racist. It's awful in a lot of ways, but the language that Herman Melville uses is just, it's just amazing. And every time I think of it, I think of Blades in the Dark, and I start thinking of these characters. I start thinking about like someone who's come back from Leviathan hunting, or somebody who like works on the docks, or like somebody who leases out, who like buys a boat and invests in it and then sees what happens when it goes out. Like all of these, I mean, so much of the Leviathan hunting from Blades in the Dark comes from whale hunting, our history of whale hunting and all of its various horrors. And when they talk about the anatomy of a sperm whale, which is totally wrong, like he is just straight making things up, but he's making things up in the most fascinating way, in those fascinating details. So it gets me, it always kind of engages my because I know he's just BSing, it really engages my my world building brain. And I could do that too. I'm gonna make up these things and hopefully not make up these things with awful racist elements in them, but that creative,
can be true, right, Sean? Yeah, I mean, yeah, the guy can be an amazing writer, and obviously, Melville changed how books were written, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. And his book can be full of a bunch of garbage too. Thing about me with Melville, and I think this is tying to a lot of what you said, is his ability to the decisions on details, things that he focuses on, that the first time you read Moby Dick, you're like, oh, okay, that was good. And then you read it again, you go, oh, now I know why he was very specific about this person's hair and very specific about this part of the ship. And that's very, very good. Well, guys, this was a real pleasure. You guys were wonderful to come on with very little notice, and I do appreciate it. We've got the obvious plug for the book, and everybody who scrolls down right now can go right now to Game Found and prove to everybody that Game Found was the best decision ever. And
that would be great. Yes, please. Please do that.
A few dollars and join me in backing it. But Karen, is there any other things that you'd like to plug or any other places people can go to get more Karen?
Yeah, if you're interested in learning more about improv in general, I love helping people get started. And, I have a lot of recommendations in the Bay Area, at least for theaters that I'm familiar with. Again, depending on, what type of thing people want to get into, if you are interested in the performance aspect of it. I also do teach improv as team building workshops. And because I love doing that, again, it's kind of the same thing. I just love playing those types of games and seeing how they are a fun and very approachable way to practice human skills. So if that is something that people are interested in doing, is, putting together kind of just a fun play day for their team or for their friends, they can absolutely reach out to me.
And how would they do that?
They can go to improvforeverybody.com or just find me on Twitter, K-12s, or on Instagram or TikTok.
And again, everybody scroll down. We've got all the links there. How about for you, Sean? Any plugs or anything where we need to go to get more Sean?
Sure. I mean, you can find me pretty much everywhere at Sean Nittner. It's my email. It's my Twitter. It's that's me everywhere. Obviously, as we said, we're crowdfunding Improv for Gamers right now. We're also getting very close with a couple other games at Evil Hat that just went into layout, which is a very finishing stage for us. Apocalypse Keys by Ray Najati is just about to go into layout and then probably early next week. And that means people should be seeing things like that. We'll probably be crowdfunding that in a few months. Fate of Umdar, our game, our sort of Thundar the Barbarian version of with a very anti-colonialist bend fate game, is going to be going to playtest very soon. And Grow by Moonlight, I think, is also going to be hitting layout really soon. So just a lot of things are getting these finishing stages. As a project manager, I try to keep them more spaced out, but this is how the world works. Things come early, things come late, things come when they come. And so lots more fun stuff from the hat coming out soon. And of course, I would be remiss not to say that Big Bad Online is happening May 6th. Yeah. This has already happened. If this is after May 6th, when you're hearing this, then it's all available on YouTube and you can watch it. And we're going to have 24 hours of amazing panelists presenting on so many different topics. And I am just floored with the various communities that we have speaking. We have Native American communities that developed Coyote and Crow speaking. We have a Brazilian contingent of folks that are all translating games in Brazil. We have the Desis and Dragons folks that are in India that are talking about sort of the tabletop scene in India. We have folks in Southeast Asia. This is the most international, the diverse Big Bad has ever been. And we're going to have so many fantastic panels talking about just so many more different experiences that I think we've ever had before. So May 6th, 6 p.m. to 6 p.m. May 7th is 24 hours free, but we have a fundraiser. And if you want to support that, we would certainly appreciate it.
Very, very cool.
That's my shtick. Sorry.
That's okay, Sean. And then now it's a two-parter. So I'm kidding.
legit.
But as I've already said to Sean, but I'll say it to you, Karen, I will come up with another excuse to get you on because I really enjoyed this and I appreciate you taking the time.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Awesome. And those of you listening, you listened to the whole thing and this is the end. And I want you to know I appreciate you too. Take care.
This episode, subscribe to Tabletop Talk and share it with your friends. Check out our content on YouTube and Twitch. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook and stay updated on everything coming from Third Floor. All the links are in the show notes. Take care, floorheads.
You still here? Wow. Well, the episode is over, but if you're bored, why not go to patreon.com and support the show for as little as $1 a month? Yeah, you can just scroll down and yeah, get the link. It's Patreon that makes this and all of our other content possible. Don't you want to join the other floorheads on the Patreon Discord? Anyway, thanks for sticking around. Take care.